Well, good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you might be on this beautiful planet, and welcome to the creative field. I am Jeannie Martin, and I am your host here on bbsradio.com every second Sunday night at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. We are here because of the support of our sponsors, Emissaries of Divine Light, British Columbia, and Edenvale Retreat and Conference Center in Abbotsford, British Columbia. Edenvale is located in West Abbotsford, about 1 hour from Vancouver. It is a beautiful retreat and meeting spot for groups and workshops, family gatherings, and more. So please visit Edenvale's website at www.edenvaleretreat.ca and have a virtual look around the beautiful land and the facilities. The creative field is here to do just what it says, to provide a creative field for ideas and solutions that support a sustainable, harmonious life on planet Earth. To focus on what is possible, to learn from others who are working diligently in their own unique ways to sustain and maintain a healthy, natural environment that will support life in all forms for generations to come. We invite special guests who are doing just that, working hard and diligently to support and sustain life in harmonious and positive ways. When we respect all life, we find that life is very simple and beautiful. Harmony with life provides abundance for all of us. So before I introduce our guests tonight, I would like to invite you to join in our conversation as we go through the program. We'll be inviting you to call us, and we welcome your questions and your comments. So call in for free. Ask any questions that you may have, and you can call us toll-free at 1-888-627-6008. Once again, that number is 888-627-6008. I am really pleased to have our guest with us tonight, and particularly have a great interest in what they will be sharing with us. Mike and Judy Campbell are co-owners of Campbell's Gold Honey Farm and Meadery. They operate an 8-acre farm, including an apiary in southwest Abbotsford. They offer off-farm honeybee pollination services to local growers, and they focus on honey and honey wine production. As most of us know, there's been a lot of talk over this last number of years about our bee populations, and there's many different things that are going on that I know that Judy and Mike can give us some really interesting information about tonight. Mike was a teacher for 35-plus years, and he took up the hobby of beekeeping about 17 years ago before he retired. So as he approached his retirement, he and Judy decided that they would take Mike's beekeeping and honey wine hobby activities and develop them into what is today a very thriving business. Mike has been active in both the Surrey and Langley Bee Clubs, and he served a term as second vice president of the BC Honey Producers Association. Over the last 3 years, Mike has worked alongside of researchers to examine the challenges that are facing bees and is named as a co-author in papers that are proposed for publication. Judy is a retired federal public service manager who, she says, reluctantly joined Mike in his beekeeping hobby at the outset. So she had a fear of bees when they first started beekeeping and decided to focus on honey production, which is the production part and the sales of their business. Her passion for gardening and arts and crafts have contributed to the entrepreneurial approach that they have developed in these recent years. So Mike convinced Judy early on to take the beginner's beekeeping training program, which is offered by the Ministry of Agriculture. And slowly with education, Judy has overcome what she considers her irrational fear of bees. And Mike has completed the Master Beekeeper course, and then Judy completed the same course some years after Mike. So their passion is in bees, in all aspects of bees, bee education. They provide educational tours and activities. They offer beekeeping workshops, advanced and beginners. And the what I didn't know when I look at the word meadery, I didn't know what that was. But really what that is, it's a honey winery. So they produce a variety of honey wines, including Ancient Mead, Melomed's honey fruit wines, and honey grape wines, and much, much more. So, without further ado, I would like to welcome both of our guests, Judy and Mike Campbell, and welcome to both of you.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Well, I am really very, very excited to learn about bees tonight. You know, it's... When I think back when I was a little girl and we used to have a lot of bees, and I just don't see as many of those bees around these days. So how about if we start by asking you, how did you get into beekeeping?
We started...
Hi there.
We started by somebody actually gave us a hive... They had a hive for bee sting therapy. Hello?
Mm-hmm.
And they had neighbors that were very upset about them having this hive in their subdivision, and the hive had fallen over, and it was needing some tender, loving care. And so they asked me if I would take care of it for them, and I said, okay. And Judy said, okay, but only if you put it right at the very, very back of the property. And
so that's how you became, that was your first lunch at beekeeping, was it? And so did you fall in love with the bees right away?
It was actually not my first experience with bees. My father had a small acreage in Surrey at one point in our life, and there was a beekeeper there that kept 10 hives. And at school, when I was going to school back in the 50s and 60s, there used to be an apiary right on the school site because they had an agriculture program. So I've actually been involved off and on with bees for a long, long time.
And Judy came along reluctantly at first and is now completely involved in the beekeeping and the production of the honey. Is that right?
Her eyes are much better than mine, so she's very good with grafting queens. Where you take eggs that are 3 days old and transfer them into queen breeding areas and create new queens. And she's also heavily involved in the production of the wine and the honey. And I just sort of hang out outside with the bees. So it's very... good for the soul. You have to calm yourself to work with bees, and you have to pay attention to nature, so it's very, it can be physically challenging, but it's very good psychologically for you.
Yeah. You just said something that was very interesting to me. You said you have to be calm to work with the bees?
Yeah. You have when you work with bees, you have to sort of understand that they have their own little persnickety nature. They don't like jewelry. They don't like perfume. They don't like rapid movements, and they don't like fear, and they don't like sweat. So, you just
have to put yourself
down, and you get excellent biofeedback if you are in any way cantankerous to them.
So do you get stung?
That's when you get stung, is if you misbehave. If you don't misbehave, I seldom get stung. As a matter of fact, today I was outside working with the bees, and I was just wearing a T-shirt and doing 50 or 60 hives. I don't think I got stung at all.
Well, when you get stung, do you start to get used to it?
Well, for me, the bee venom actually helps with my arthritis, so I don't mind if I do get stung, but most of the time, if I do get stung, I simply scratch the sting off and carry on without being bothered by it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing people who have nasty reactions have more likely been stung by a wasp than by a bee. The venom is different, and if you've been stung by a bee, if you notice a stinger sticking in you, just scrape it sideways, and usually there's no reaction.
Oh, I see. And, you know, I guess the bees get a pretty bad rap because of the wasps, is that right?
That's correct. A wasp can actually sting you 9 times in a minute. And then it takes you, or it takes the wasp about 30 seconds to recharge its venom sac, and it can sting you 9 more times. So they usually sting you multiple times, and then to top it all off, they, because they're meat eaters, they take a bite of your meat and take it back to their nest to feed to their young. So you get stung plus eaten. Not very pleasant experience.
So is the wasps and the bees, are the wasps a threat to the bees at all?
Absolutely.
What happens there?
Wasps mark a hive, and then they send basically soldier wasps against a hive, and they'll kill all the guards at the front of the beehive, and once all the guards have been killed, they'll go in and kill the queen, and then they'll eat all the babies. They'll rip all the muscles out of the back of the working bees and leave a bunch of dead bees behind and kill off the hive in no time flat.
Wow. So as a beekeeper, do you have to really be aware of wasps that are in the area? Like if they have a wasp nest close, then your hives are...
Yeah, we try and trap the wasps now.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point of the year, only the wasp queens are flying. So any of the wasps that you catch now will stop 50 or 60,000 wasps from attacking your bees in August.
Wow, that's amazing. I had never, ever heard of such a thing. Well, I'm going to pay attention to... So at this particular time of the year, then, it's the queen wasps that are flying around. And so would you encourage people to catch them?
Yes. Get a good wasp trap. Mm-hmm. There's lots of good commercially available ones, and you'll have far fewer problems later in the summer.
Mm-hmm. So
what happens is only the wasp queen overwinters. So in the first thing in the spring, she'll go out and kill a few insects, bring back the dead meat to what she's going to start as a nest. When the meat is good and rotten, she'll lay some eggs and feed the larva rotten meat, and the larva eat the rotten meat, and then they will grow into some daughters that will assist their mother in going and collecting more meat, and when they eventually get to a good mass of wasps, then the queen will just stay behind and produce as much young as the daughters are bringing rotten meat for.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get bit by a wasp,
mm-hmm.
You're also being bitten by something that's been handling lots of putrid meat, so you can get nasty infections from the bite as well as the pain of the sting.
And so honeybees, they don't sting in that same way at all. They don't take a bite out of you.
Honeybees are entirely vegetarian.
Oh.
So their source of protein is pollen from flowers, which they feed their babies, and they get energy by collecting nectar from flowers, which also is used to produce honey. So they have a totally different diet from wasps.
Mm-hmm.
And honeybees in particular have a very weak immune system, so they're extremely fastidious about being sterile in the hive. Everything is cleaned. They create disinfectants from collecting pitches and tars from plants and modifying them. And they produce a stuff called propolis, which is a strong antiviral, antifungal, antibacterial substance. And they paint everything in the hive with propolis, and it renders everything sterile inside.
Interesting. And you were saying that when you get stung by a bee, it helps arthritis? How does that work?
It helps some people. My wife and I went to a conference years ago, and most of the people at the conference were MS sufferers. From what we heard at the conference, about a third of the people with arthritis and MS can show big improvement by having bee sting therapy, and about two-thirds of the people have no terrible reaction at all, or no beneficial reaction. So if you're one of the third that has a good reaction, it's well worth trying. And it's basically the medical reason for it is that your body creates cortisone around the areas that are stung, and the cortisone that you create for yourself is what is very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Now, you, when I called you the other day, you were getting some queen bees in, and what I wanted to ask you was, when you have a hive, how do you recognize a queen bee, for one thing?
If you're not familiar with bee biology, it takes a little bit of a knack to distinguish between the different types. But boys are big and fat and sort of slow, and they're kind of docile and dumb. And the boys can't sting as well. They have no stinger. the girls are either going to be queens or they're going to be workers. And the queens get a special high protein diet for the first few days of their life, and that makes them much larger than the other workers. So all work in the hive is done by females. The queen's work is having babies, and the worker's work is to produce honey and pollen and collect propolis and look after the queen. So with a practiced eye, you can actually spot the queen fairly easily.
So would they allow more than one queen in a hive then?
The queen will kill any competitors.
I see.
So when a new queen is created, she will go look for her mother and rip her mother's head off.
And so, oh my goodness.
She'll be left with the new, as the only queen.
Mm-hmm. And how long does a queen live?
A queen can live for up to 5 years, but in our beekeeping operation, we replace them every year.
Okay.
And the reason for that is newer queens have more girl babies than boy babies and more babies altogether. So what you want in a honey operation is to have lots and lots of girl babies because they're the ones that do lots of work. As the queen gets older, she'll have more and more boy babies because she only mates once in her life. She may mate with up to 15 or 30 different drones in the 10 or 15 minutes that she's out mating. But she will store their sperm for up to 5 years. And every time she decides to have a girl baby, she takes one sperm and adds it to one of her eggs, and you get a girl. When she actually clones herself, you get a bee that's identical to his mother in every way except that it only has one chromosome and it's a male.
And she knows the difference?
Kind of weird science.
Does she know the difference between adding that to get a girl baby?
The queen basically will choose to have girl babies over boy babies, unless she runs into some comb that the bees have prepared for her that is bigger, and then she will switch to laying drone babies.
Mm-hmm.
And if she's running short of sperm or her sperm supply was poor because she was poorly mated, then she will have more boy babies, and her daughters will monitor her performance.
Mm-hmm.
If she's having too many boys, they'll get rid of her and replace her with a new queen.
Wow. So, would, I've noticed out in nature when you're thinking about wasps that some of those nests become huge. With a beehive, is there an optimum level, or do they, if they were out in the wild, would they just get, the hive get bigger and bigger and bigger over time?
In the old days, say back before the early 1990s, hives would get very large. But then in the 1990s, we developed this pest. It was somebody illegally imported it into Florida, and within 4 or 5 years, it had spread all throughout North America. And now there are no wild bees. Bees can't exist in the wild without being managed by a person.
Well, and that's because of that, bringing those, what you call them, immigrant bees into the country.
It was actually a pest on immigrant bees. It was called Varroa jacobini, and now it's been renamed Varroa destructor because it's a very destructive little pest. It basically in a regular bee season up here, you have 3 generations of bees, but you have 28 generations of the varroa destructor. It multiplies at an astronomical rate. You have one mite introduced into the hive. 12 days later, you have 25. 12 days after that, you have 525. 36 days after the first introduction, you have 14,400. And then after that, it's in the hundreds of thousands. And at that point, the hive is dead.
Wow. You know, we hear a lot about colony collapse disorder. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, colony collapse disorder is poorly understood, and it's often mislabeled, a misapplied label for poor bee management. But true colony collapse disorder is where you will go into a hive and you will find abandoned babies, abandoned honey, very few or no bees, and in a normal situation where you have bees around that and there's a honey and pollen source nearby that isn't being protected by other bees, other bees would normally go in and rob that abandoned colony out, but the bees in the neighborhood will very carefully avoid that hive, so there's something about it that they don't like, and the current thinking is that it's probably the result of some new pesticides that were introduced in the mid-1990s or early 1990s, and they're synthetic nicotinoids, and if they're allowed to get into the environment or especially into the water table, they're toxic to bees for years after they've been applied or misapplied.
Do cell phone towers and things like that affect the bees?
Sometimes you read things that are just nonsense according to science. Cell phone towers might affect bats who do use sonar to navigate, but bees are actually celestial navigators. They actually come out of their hive and they memorize the location of all the stars in the sky, and that's how they get around, so cell phone radiation probably has no effect on bees at all.
Mm. And if the bees in a hive, how far would they, when they leave the hive in the morning or whenever they go, how far do bees usually go to collect their pollen and do their job and then come back to the hive?
Well, bees are very efficient. So when you put a hive in a new location, they send the old girls out first, girls who are at the end of their life, and nobody really cares if they live or die, if they get lost on their first flight from the new location. It's really not that much of a big deal for the hive. But if they find either honey or pollen within 150 feet of the hive, they come back and they do what's called a round dance, and they tell all their sisters where all the good food is. And then after observing the round dance, their sisters will immediately go and swarm the circle right around the hive with some foragers, and they will find the new food source and bring it back to the hive. But if there is no food within 150 feet of the hive, then what they will do is go further afield, and they can go up to 5 miles. And when they come back from that food source, say it's 5 miles away, they'll have a little bit of honey and a little bit of pollen, and they'll pass it around to their sisters. And then they do a different kind of a dance, and their sisters will very carefully watch this dance. The foraging bee that found the new food will wiggle her bum and describe a trajectory on the frames, and the number of wiggles of her bum is bee distance for how far away the food is, and within a minute or two of the dance finishing, the bees will, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 bees can be traveling up to 5 miles away to the new food source. So there, it's a very complicated communication system they have.
That's amazing.
But it works really well.
Oh, it's got to be some very refined intelligence going on there, right? And would you say that in the hive, when the young are born, they just have that information? They just know what the dance is going to tell them?
They probably have that innate to them because, or at least understand it innately, because obviously the bees that do the foraging in the spring have been in the hive all winter long, so they've never seen a dance. All the bees that danced last year have long since died, and yet bees can figure out where the food is this year and carry on.
Mm-hmm. So you were saying that normally a queen bee lives up to 5 years old, and then you replace them every year. So do the rest of the bees also live for 5 years in the hive?
No. Boys are sort of created about mid-May, mm-hmm. and they'll hang around until the end of summer, end of August usually, and they're accepted at any hive. They just go and they beg for food, they open their mouth and they make a noise that's very irritating to the girls, and the girls run and get food and shove it down his throat until he stops whining. So boys can live about 2.5 months in the summer, and then at the end of August, when there's no need for boys anymore, the girls will kill them all off. So there are no boys from September till mid-May. And working girls in the summer will be lucky to live a month or 5 weeks, and they'll eventually, you'll see old bees with their wings worn down or their legs worn off, and when they can't produce more food than they eat, their sisters will either kill them off or kick them out. And then bees that are born mid-September to mid-November here are called winter bees, and they're obviously genetically the same as summer bees, but they have a totally different blood system, and they can live 4 to 5 months.
Interesting. So, I wonder if you could tell us, Mike, I mean, bees are very, very important to life on planet Earth, aren't they? Without bees, we'd be in trouble.
Well, we were at a very interesting conference at the World Beekeeping Conference a couple of years ago, and there was a report by an economist from the United Kingdom, and she had done the actual value of bees for apple production. And she estimated that the cost of an apple, if you had to pollinate it in a different source rather than using bees, would jump to around £10 or $20 an apple.
Oh my gosh.
Which would mean that most people couldn't afford to eat apples. And
they pollinate so many other plants on the planet as well. I mean,
actually, about 30% of our food supply is heavily dependent on the honeybee for pollination. Our first local crop here is blueberries, and there's about 7 million flowers per acre in a blueberry patch, and each one of those flowers needs to be visited multiple times by a pollinator. There are mason bees and there are bumblebees around at the same time, but they don't have the numbers to get into that 7 million, because you need about 80 or 85 million visits per acre in the few days that the flower is viable. And then we have raspberries, and raspberries will produce about 30 to 40% more with proper pollination. Your vegetable seeds, like carrots and onions, all require honeybees to produce the seed. So if you don't have good pollination early in the spring for carrots or onions, then you don't get carrots or onion seeds growing. So,
interesting.
Most people don't think of those as pollinated plants, but the seeds are extremely dependent upon pollination.
Yeah. I'm involved in a community garden project that's just starting in the next month. Would you say that it's a good idea for someone to have a beehive close to a community garden? Does it help?
I guess it depends what you're growing. If you're growing root crops, mm-hmm. It probably doesn't. But if, for example, we have our currants are just coming into bloom right now, and we get an extremely good crop of red currants, white currants, and black currants, because we always have a few hundred beehives around at the time that they're blooming. We get good apple, pear, plum crops because we have proper pollination. In terms mm-hmm. of a vegetable garden, I'm not sure which vegetables actually require pollination during the time they're growing. If you're going to have them for seed, then you need to have pollination. Corn is a crop that isn't terribly attractive to bees, but they do work on pollen collecting and spreading in corn. And corn actually is one of the problems for bees, because a lot of the corn is treated with these synthetic nicotinoids that we talk about.
Yeah.
And it's toxic to, or they've made it toxic to bees. And sometimes they've actually incorporated into the corn itself through GMO processes toxins to the bees. And so when the bees even go to drink the water off the leaf on the corn plant, they'll be killed. So
I've got to ask the next question, and of course it might be speculation, but why would they do that? Why would they want to talk to kill the bees?
They don't particularly want to kill bees by making the corn toxic, but they want to kill whatever bugs infest corn.
And the price.
When I was growing up, we always grew corn, and we never had any problems with bugs infecting it. But
so the price that we pay for the genetically modified corn is the death of our bees.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. How much? You know, I'm a lover of honey, and so when I even have tea, I put honey in my tea, and we buy one of those big containers of honey, and I'm always looking at it thinking, how many bees did it take to make this container full of honey? So how much does a bee actually produce honey-wise?
A lifetime work for a girl is about a quarter of a teaspoon or 1 gram.
Oh, my gosh.
So if you have a kilo jar of honey, that's the lifetime work of 1,000 bees.
Oh, my gosh. I'm going to respect my honey even more now. That's amazing. And, you know, my grandmother, when I look back, I'm a grandmother now, so when I look back in my life, and like I was saying earlier, there was a lot of bees around. They were landing on the clover, and they were all over the place, and we weren't afraid of them at all. Now they're talking, I don't know if honey has changed. Should it be pasteurized? Should honey be pasteurized?
Well, my thinking of pasteurizing of honey is that it's a dumb thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you heat honey and destroy the enzymes in it, it will go bad. And that's basically what you do with pasteurizing. Honey by itself is a pure product. It has a shelf life of thousands of years if it's not pasteurized. It just baffles me why anybody would want to pasteurize it.
So the honey that we buy from you is certainly not the honey that we're going to see in the grocery store unless it says right on it, unpasteurized. Is that right?
I don't know what you see exactly in the grocery store as regards to pasteurized or non-pasteurized. The honey from any local beekeeper is probably superior in that it might be a specific flower source. For example, we take our honey off after each crop that the bees have been in. And each honey, then, it tastes, the differences are subtle, but there is a subtle difference between blueberry honey and raspberry honey, or lavender, or buckwheat, or fireweed. And and that's one of the things that people really like about buying honey from a local beekeeper.
Yeah.
If I were in a grocery store looking, I would always want to check to make sure that what I was buying was exclusively a product of Canada, because some poor quality honeys can be imported and blended with other honeys. So if it says a blend of Canadian and some other country's honey, I would really want to know about the provenance of the honey and who's inspected it and so on.
Good. And are there any other products that bees make that are useful to humans? What else do they do?
Well, maybe Judy should tell you about candles and propolis.
Huh. I wonder if Judy's there.
Hi, Judy.
Thank you. I was just asking, Mike, if there's any other products that the bees make that are useful to humans.
Yeah, there are. First, beeswax is a magical product that they make. When you burn a beeswax candle, it'll send negative ions out into the air that attract and trap viruses, mold, mildew, bacteria, and they'll extinguish them. So beeswax is a wonderful, it has a wonderful aroma when it's burning as a candle, but it also has a very functional value for burning.
That's amazing.
Propolis, Mike mentioned propolis earlier, the antiseptic that the bees produce, can actually be put into salves for external use by human beings. And because it's antiviral, antifungal, it actually protects, cuts, sores, and burns from bacteria entering and helps them heal much faster.
So if somebody had a fungus infection, you could put that on there and that would help?
Yeah, I don't know whether with fungal, I think I'd get medical doctor's advice on that. But a cut, a scrape, a burn,
mm-hmm.
putting the actual propolis ointment on the skin will provide a protective layer and won't allow bacteria to get in, which speeds up the healing.
Wow.
In fact, yeah, we had heard that they... somewhere out there in the pharmaceutical world, they were considering putting honey as well as some propolis on Band-Aids. Now, I just heard that. I haven't actually seen it.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about propolis. Propolis, not only for external use, but can be put in a tincture and taken internally. And it's almost like, I guess it's the equivalent of an echinacea. It's the beehive equivalent to echinacea if
mm-hmm.
it's put in a tincture for.
Interesting.
There's magical properties that come from the beehive. The beeswax can be put into soaps so the skin doesn't dry out as quickly, into lip balms that help protect the lips from drying out. It's phenomenal. There's an endless array of products. And, of course, then if we've got the honey that goes into the honey wine, and that's always a treat as a product.
I can't believe I lived this long on the planet and didn't know about honey wine.
You know, it's believed to be the oldest known alcoholic beverage on the planet.
Oh, my gosh.
It's called mead, M-E-A-D.
And so you take the honey and you age it? How does that work?
Well, mead in a very simplistic fashion is water, yeast, and honey, fermented in magical combinations. And it's referred to as the nectar of the gods.
That's an appropriate name for it. I mean, mm-hmm. everything I've heard so far tonight, I'm absolutely fascinated with this information. And I know that at your location there, you have a little store, don't you?
We do. We put up a little store on the property,
mm-hmm.
and we let people come in and have a taste treat. They sample the salves and the tinctures and even the honey wine.
Even the honey wine?
Even the honey wine.
I was going to ask you, too, we had talked about that there's on May 29th is the
mm-hmm.
International Day of the Honeybee.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that and how they might participate in that?
Well, you know, about 2 or 3 years ago, the BC Honey Producers Association felt, with all the challenges there were for beekeepers and bees, that there was a need to draw the public's attention to the issues so that the public could become informed. And they engaged beekeepers around the world to just reach out to their local communities. Some farmers' markets have honey vendors who do education on a regular basis, but on May the 29th, beekeepers are encouraged to go to farmers' markets. For example, here on the farm, we'll have an educational display, and we'll probably, if the weather's good, walk people out to live hives. But their local beekeeping association is probably thinking about doing some activities. Farmers markets, honey vendors, beekeepers. Basically, we're encouraged to reach out and touch the community and invite them to learn a bit more about bees and the challenges.
Yeah, it's really shocking to hear that there are no more bees living in the wild. I can't even imagine.
Sorry, go ahead. I mean, there may be the odd feral colony out there that, who knows? I mean, we can never say never, but for the most part, that time has passed.
Oh, my gosh. That's shocking. I find that really shocking.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody wanted to start beekeeping, what advice would you have for them?
I would tell them, my best advice is to join a beekeeping club. There's lots of local beekeeping clubs, and they can get an inventory of where they are from the BC Honey Producers Association website. Just be BCHPA. Google it and they'll find the website. And they can find the local bee club closest to them. Usually they meet once a month. They have a social aspect and educational aspect. So the first thing I'd suggest is that people actually find a bee club and just look, listen, and learn. Maybe take a beginning beekeeping course. And some of them are offered commercially, but the Ministry of Agriculture offers one on an annual basis. And then to buy their first hive, you know, get their equipment and begin to beekeep and work with experienced beekeepers who can help them. It looks simple, but it's not as simple as it appears. But I would encourage anyone who has even a little bit of interest to inquire further, because it's a wonderful hobby, but it also could be a great business.
Yeah, and I was noticing here, too, that, like, do you take hives to other people's places?
Yes. When we go out to pollinate, we actually move the hive out to the farmer's field. We've had lavender farms ask us if we would like to put hives into their lavender fields when they're in full bloom, and we get this lovely lavender honey, which the lavender farm will sell and will sell. We take our hives out to pumpkin patches, so we get a great pumpkin honey. Some of those pollination contracts were paid for, and others we just do because we want to gather different types of honey.
Fascinating. And you and Mike, you also have educational tours.
Yeah, we actually do preschool right up to seniors, and we've had seniors over 100 years old come to our tours. It's just an incredible experience to walk a small child out, or grade 1 and 2, 3, 4, up to grade 7, out to a beehive. You know, they experience the world differently than we do as adults with some established fears. They're very open to learning. The seniors don't get out to the hives, but they have all these wonderful stories about beekeeping. They remember beekeeping themselves, or they had a member of the family that kept bees. But they remember honey being produced on their own little farms. And they have a different perspective of farming than, you know, the younger generations today.
Mm-hmm. How many bees?
It's good for them and it's good for us.
Yeah. Sorry. How many bees do you have?
Hundreds of colonies. Yeah. So in a colony, you'd have, anywhere from 30 to 90,000, depending how many supers. So there's a box with 10 frames. That's called a super.
Mm-hmm.
And you can stack them. There'll be one is the nucleus colony with the queen, and you can build your bees up to two supers or add your honey super on top of that. So, you know, they can get quite large in the summer.
Fascinating. And so now you've gotten over your fear of bees.
And, you know, I can get stung. And I used to have a local swelling, but now I can get stung and I don't even swell at all. And it doesn't bother me to get stung.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I used to just cringe.
Well, I'm certainly going to be looking at bees a lot different. So when we see a bee now that's mm-hmm. on our plants, it's usually coming from a hive that's being looked after by a beekeeper.
Yes.
Wow.
And, you know, if anybody sees a bee, even a bumblebee, take a deep breath and just relax, because they don't really, they may, you know, buzz around you a bit, but they're not interested in you as a human being, because they're just looking for nectar and pollen.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's
enjoy
something
them.
I wanted
Let them
to
buzz
ask.
Around you. Yeah.
What's the difference between a honeybee and a bumblebee? Those creepy.
Well, the bumblebee is much bigger and
it's like
fuzzier
a punchy black guy.
Yeah, and it's a semi-solitary bee. It doesn't live in organized colonies like the honeybee.
I see. Because that's something else we used to see a lot of when we were children, and I know that the black bees that I see now are not those honeybees. They're not those bumblebees.
Well, there are bumblebees, there are research studies going on right in recent times anyway to look at the numbers of bumblebees. Because they believe that they were on the decline. Around our little hobby farm, because we build lots of diversity in, we see a lot of bumblebees. But bumblebees are the big, fat... Now, they're not entirely black. They can be black and yellow or black and orange, but they're big, and you can really hear the buzz.
Yeah, they're almost aerodynamically impossible to get off.
that's right.
They manage to do it. Well,
yeah.
Judy, Mike, I can't believe how fast this hour has gone, and I want to give you an opportunity to tell people how they can reach you, if you have a website, and where you're located, and then they can, maybe if they check in on your website, they can find out about the tours and the day camps that you're providing?
Absolutely. They can look us up online at www.bchoney.com, and we're located in Southwest Abbotsford, just near the border of Abbotsford and Langley. So we're really centrally located to a large population.
That's wonderful. And I'd like to ask you, how do you feel about the future of our bees?
Well, I just think we're going to keep going, and we're going to believe that something will happen that will keep these bees alive. You know, for us, the overwintering was pretty good this year. So I think it's science working with researchers and beekeepers and beekeeping associations working together in partnership that are going to help find out the real problems that the bees are facing and help develop the solutions.
And for those that really do love the bees and the passion that you have for the work, all we can do out here, those of us that don't have bees, is to do everything we can to support you and the work that you do. So what could our listeners do to enhance bee habitat? How can they help?
I'm so glad you asked that. First of all, be informed about chemicals that you use, whether they're pesticides or herbicides. Inform yourself. What are you doing to your property? The second thing, build diversity in your vegetation. You know, we go about spraying all the weeds and, you know, we've gone into monocrops. But really, we need a very diverse landscape for the health of bees. And we need nutrition. So some plants have pollen, some plants have nectar. Do some research on your plants. And, for example, I plant lots of sunflowers every year because they have a nice pollen and nectar. But seeds now are being developed that are pollenless. So look at your labels. Buy the ones that have pollen and a good nectar source. Feed the bees. Diversify your property.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay.
And is there anything else that you'd like to share before we say goodnight? I have so appreciated this conversation.
No, it's been a real pleasure for Mike and I. And if people have general questions, they can give us a call. We'll get back to them either by email or telephone. And we'd like people to begin the discussion about what they as individuals can do in their local community.
Perfect. And this has been such an educational, fascinating hour, and I thank you both so much. And
thank you.
I don't live very far away from you, so you're going to be seeing me, and I'm coming down to have a look at all those wonderful bee products that you've got.
Super. So on May 29th, we'll be taking people out, if the weather's good, to live beehives, make that the day, or August the 18th, we do a special free family fun day. So we really want to open up the farm to the community.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you both so much, and And our listeners, please get in touch with Judy and Mike if you have any questions about bees. I think that this is a very, very important subject, and that we get some serious education, because those bees are our future, and our food depends on it. So thank you both again. And I'd like to say to our listeners that we'll be back online 2 weeks from tonight at 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time with another wonderful educational program. And until then, happy Easter to everyone, and to you, Judy, and to Mike. And we will talk again and be with you once again for the creative field in 2 weeks. Thank you all, and good night.